Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. My goodness, it's already July 5. Can you imagine 2 days after the 4th of July weekend, actually 1 day after the 4th of July celebration began, and this is the long weekend that comes ahead as well. But a change in demeanor in Washington, D.C., a different sort of parade. Wonder where people stand on that whole issue. It's just a change in demeanor, I guess, and I would want to read more into it than that. And I don't know if people are going to be more happy or less happy with the outcome. We'll see what it is. At the end of the day, it's all smoke and mirrors, and we'll see how people respond to it all, which will be very interesting. Well, one thing is fascinating is that today is Friday. We're going to be speaking with Victoria Garrity. She's the mayor of Ossining. We're going to talk to her about what's going on in Ossining specifically. They had a public hearing related to Hudson Step. It's the proposed development on State Street. Very, very big news. And I'm wondering if now, after the wrangling for the budgets that took place in Albany, if that's going to impact the village, and we'll see where that goes. Also, a big thing that came into play is only a few days ago, the Albany and the governor, they signed off on allowing and permitting the Westchester County to increase its sales tax by 1%. And I know that certain places will not be affected by it at all, whereas other places like the village are going to be affected. But the biggest effect will be the fact that the revenue that will come in is going to be dispersed. I don't know what the methodology will be or how it will be dispersed, but every community will be able to get a piece of the pie, and that's going to be very compelling. I see the mayor is on, so let's bring her in. Good morning, Mayor. Happy belated 4th of July.
Good morning, Hezzy. Happy holiday weekend to you. It's a nice long weekend for a lot of us, so I hope that you and your listeners are getting a chance to enjoy this gorgeous summer weather we're having.
I'm thrilled. You know, it just seemed to be like only winter was a couple of weeks ago. and so we're in the midst of summer. Life is going by very quickly. So got to enjoy it as it's here. And it's pretty good. Well, I'm excited about what's going on. A lot of stuff is happening in the county and in Ossining, and it's impacting everything that goes on. I guess the most important issue was the passage by Albany and the governor signing off on allowing the Westchester County to get a 1% increase in
yeah.
the sales tax.
It's a huge deal for most of Westchester. It is.
Exactly. So how does that affect the village? Because there'll be disbursement from this revenue stream that will come in. It will allow the county to settle a lot of its, issues with regard to workers that work for the county. But at the same time, it will also be dispersed for education purposes and other purposes of development in places like the village.
Yeah, it's a big it's a significant financial gain for our communities. And so, yeah, you're mm-hmm. in Yonkers, and you all have a slightly higher tax rate, sales tax rate than
yes.
the rest of the county. But most of us who are not cities, all the villages mm-hmm. and towns and a couple of the smaller cities, are now at the same level as White Plains and New Rochelle and Mount Vernon.
Right.
And I have to say, when I first heard about this proposal from the county executive last winter, I was a little hesitant because sales tax is generally a regressive tax, and so I'm generally not supportive of that. But the more I learned about it, the more I came to understand that it is a pretty reasonable thing to do. The reality is most people, I think, in Western Westchester don't say, oh, I'm not going to go shopping in White Plains. I'm going to go shopping in Ossining because there's a 1% sales tax difference. That's just not the way the human mindset works. And I came to realize that most of us, including Ossining and most of Westchester, were lower not only than those cities that we were talking about in Westchester, but then Rockland and Putnam County. And now we're coming up to be comparable with all of our surrounding municipalities. So it really, it does make financial sense from a household perspective. It's not going to be a really inappropriate increase. But the big boom for the county gets, I think, $12 million. Is it that's gonna really help balance their budget, because they were, as we know, for 8 years they had budgets that were borrowing against their future. So they had to figure out a way to correct the really irresponsible financial decision making of the previous administration. For the way that and this has been a wonderful learning experience. Every time you're an elected official, you're always learning. It's an on the job training. And so when something new comes up, you learn something new. And I have to say, the sales tax distribution has always been a little mysterious and tough to get clear answers from. So this was an opportunity for me to learn exactly how it works. And it ties into something much bigger that's a federal issue that's also a big topic of discussion, which is the census. So the way this works is the county collects all of the sales tax revenue, and it doesn't matter if every single business in Ossining shut down and we had absolutely no retail business, we would still get the exact same amount of distribution of the sales tax revenue because it's based on our population. And the existing formula that they're using for this new 1% increase means that the village of Ossining is going to get about $1 million. Additional
That's
to
amazing.
Our general fund, which is significant to us. We've had this 0% tax rate increase for 3 years, and I was not anticipating we would be able to maintain it. But if we're going to have this significant increase in our revenue in the coming year and in the foreseeable future, that makes a significant difference. And, battling the high taxes in Westchester is something we all do, but in Ossining in particular, we have one of the highest effective tax rates, and that means you might get a much bigger house for $400,000 in Ossining than you do in, let's say, Briarcliff or Bedford. But your tax rate on that $400,000 house, it's going to be a big house, and you're going to be paying more taxes in Ossining in a $400,000 house than you would in some of the other Westchester communities. So what do we do about that? Well, we try to ideally the taxes would go down, but for starters, we just try to not have them go up. And so having this additional revenue source from sales tax is going to help us to be able to address the effective tax rate. Now, the schools, the way the formula works, municipalities get a larger percentage than the schools do. So the school district, which actually covers a larger population, I think their distribution in Ossining is a little less than $1 million, even though it's a larger population that it represents. And the formulas are so crazy and who knows how that negotiation ever happened years ago when that was first set into play. But it makes a big difference, not only for the county, but for local governments and school districts. So we're very, very happy about it. But the bigger topic that comes out of this that's important to address and that we're thinking a lot about and preparing for a lot in Ossining is the census. Now it's almost 2020, and we could talk all day about what the crazy happenings at the federal government level with the president and the Supreme Court and what's going on with the citizenship question. But whatever happens with the citizenship question, we know we have a population that is tends to be undercounted, so we don't have an accurate count in Ossining, and that happens particularly in communities that are in lower socioeconomic levels, but particularly because of immigration rates. And we have a very high rate of immigration in our community, whether documented or undocumented, and that breeds a lot of mistrust in the government, and it's just more difficult to get an accurate count. And the government knows that.
Go ahead.
I just want to tie it back to the reason why it's so significant in the sales tax question is because our sales tax distribution is based on the 2010 census numbers. 2010 census, which were it was inaccurate to begin with, and it's way, way out of date now in 2019.
Well, I guess that's a big question. So is there an ancillary aspect to this incentive and this new tax rate? I mean, are more people going to have babies? I mean, it's so that we have a larger population. And then, so it's like make love, not war. So, but leave the kids in from high school and all that out of the equation. That should not be an incentive for them. And then, but the other question is, I thought that it was already agreed that the question of whether what an individual's status was in the United States, whether it was citizens or not, was not going to be included, or has that not really been decided yet?
So the last that I had read was, yes,
okay.
the U.S. Supreme Court had essentially, thanks to John Roberts, who more or less sided with the progressives, but they didn't come up with a conclusive argument. What they said is that the justification for the citizenship question was sort of, BS. And so they kicked it back down to the lower court and said to the government agency, the department that brought the suit, that they needed to find a better justification for it. And so
right.
that sort of gave them a little bit of life. But what the president has now directed his departments to do is to just ignore the U.S. Supreme. And so the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, the question cannot be there. You have not demonstrated that the question can be there.
Mm-hmm.
And the census office was saying, well, things need to be printed. I don't know why things have to be printed in July for a 2020 census, but that's what they're saying. And the president has just simply told his staff to defy the order of the U.S. Supreme Court and to just print it. He'll find a way to make it legal. And to
mm-hmm.
me, that is the most absurd thing I've ever heard. I go and I visit children's classrooms and say, what are the three branches of government? We have three branches of government, and, 8-year-old kids know what those three branches are. Those are co-equal branches of government. The president doesn't get to override the U.S. Supreme Court. That's just not how
mm-hmm.
it works. But the president obviously doesn't understand that. So he is just directing his staff to ignore the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, maybe he didn't finish those schooling years when they taught that. You never can tell. nothing will surprise me anymore. I mean, the world is upside down as far as I look at it. This is really is this a reprieve for Ossining specifically? One of the problems that I've seen in other communities, such as New York City and in places like Yonkers, a lot of poll workers were afraid to go to certain buildings in certain neighborhoods. Is there any way to make a correction to that?
You mean for the census to be done more effectively?
Census workers, yeah.
Did I ever tell you, Kehezi, that in the year 2000 I was a census worker knocking on doors and filling out people's forms? I was in 2000.
Okay.
I was working freelance, so it worked into my life at the time. It was a really interesting experience. A lot has happened in the last 10 years and certainly in the last 20 years. We are in Ossining. In fact, I received a phone call a month or two ago from Chuck Schumer's office. And
mm-hmm.
he had identified Ossining as one of the communities, obviously he's focusing on New York State, but one of the communities that might need some extra resources and support to get an accurate count. So I was very pleased that our senator was making that effort and paying attention to it. And so what we've done is we have set up a meeting that's going to happen later in July with all of our community partners, and that's at every level of government, local, county, and state representatives have been invited to meet. The village is hosting this meeting at one of
mm-hmm.
our municipal buildings. And we've also invited, and this is critical to the things that you were talking about. I mean, they will talk to us about job opportunities would look to hire local people who are familiar with the community, who are bilingual. But more than that, it's also going to be about community partners being part of this. Hold on just one quick second, Heavy.
Sure, go ahead. Take your time. While the mayor is doing whatever she needs to do,
I'm in another question.
Oh, go ahead. No problem.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I just wanted to close the door. I'm in a space that where there's suddenly some noise. We're working with community partners who have different relationships with our residents. Because sometimes government can be intimidating, and people will be reluctant to
mm-hmm.
want to open the door and communicate with government. But if they hear from a local agency that is a partner to them, like we have Neighbors Link, who works specifically with the immigrant community for healthy integration of for the whole community, and as well as Open Door, which is our local healthcare facility that works largely with our Latino population and an uninsured population, which also tends to be undocumented in many cases, and work with IFCA, which is our affordable housing agency. So you get the idea. These agencies are already providing services in the community, and they have developed a level of trust in the community, as well as working with the churches and with the schools. So we've invited all of these community partners to come and have a meeting with the assistant regional director for the Northeast of the U.S. Census. And she's going to come and meet with all of us to talk about, you know, the timeline and the jobs involved. But really, what I'm hoping to get out of it is to identify what are some of the resources that the U.S. Census Bureau can offer for our community so that we can have an effective count. And one of the key players that I know they're working with throughout Westchester and I think throughout the country is libraries, because this is going to be much more online and much less door-to-door. So in the year 2000, the only way to do it was you put it in the mail and you mailed it back, and all of my door knocking to people, it was pieces of paper that then I'd put in an envelope and turn into my supervisor every other week or so. And now most of it's going to be done online. So that means we can go with a group of either volunteers or those local community resources we're talking about it, or additionally with some of the resources from the Census Bureau and our local area, go to the church on a Sunday and invite people to come and fill out their census paperwork there after Mass. Something along those lines. As many opportunities as we can to help people make it convenient for people to get counted accurately. And that goes back to what you first started talking about, which is to make sure. I mean, there's so many reasons to have an accurate count, but one of them from a municipal government perspective, and anybody who pays taxes or rent in Westchester County or at Ossining should know that if we don't have an accurate count, then we're not being able to access as much revenue as is due to our community to help pay for the services we all share. So that's just one of the little things is the distribution of tax revenue for sales tax.
Well, it's definitely going to be a patriotic move for people in Ossining to take care of Ossining, and other communities will take care of their own. But I never understood that. I thought that everything had to go door to door. So the prospect of it being moved over to the churches and other places of safety, like the library and other places that people can congregate, or maybe even go to the schools. You know, that would be a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. How do they, and then it's all done electronically after that. So in other words, you invite everybody to the library and they could fill out their form and it's all done online.
Exactly. So the Westchester Library System has been partnering with the U.S. Census office for the North and Eastern region, and training some staff at the library to be able to help walk people through the process, because obviously we have computers here at the library. So it's best if we could be done online, but we understand that, or the U.S. Census understands, not everybody has access to a computer. So doing it at having it at the library, you know, it has multiple benefits. The computers are right there. They have staff at the library who can be trained to help people. And like you said, it's a trusted location for people. Now, there are some really tough questions that we know we're going to be asked.
Yeah.
Now, whether the citizenship question...
How do you validate where these people actually live?
Well, yes, there's a lot of that, and I'll let the census figure that out. They think they have it figured out.
Okay.
They think they do. But the tricky thing is, what do you tell to people who are scared? If they're living in the shadows for a reason, and in the past, whether this question was on the census or not, we didn't have the kind of rhetoric that we do today, and not just rhetoric, but action against immigrants, where they're, I won't even go into the discussion of the horrifying conditions that we're seeing on the border, but the rhetoric and the actions that we've seen of people being deported in our own community. And every time there's a big story like that, people get scared. And so giving the government the information of who you are and where you live and exactly how many people are in your household, and is your household overcrowded, and do you have documentation? Are you a citizen? All of these questions make people very nervous. Now, there is a federal law that says that that information cannot be shared and cannot be used for any reason other than the census count. So Mm-hmm. If the law is upheld, then people, there's no reason for people to fear that responding to the census will in any way jeopardize their ability to live here while they're going through their process, whatever process. Most people are actually trying to go through a legal process to be here and in the court system. But
right.
If you fill out the census, it should not jeopardize your ability to live here. That's a totally separate issue. But it's a very reasonable fear for people to have. We have a president who right now is
Absolutely.
Defying a U.S. Supreme Court order. So, and there's
right.
also threats and with all of the DACA recipients who were told the same
mm-hmm.
thing when they signed up for DACA, and then that
right.
information was threatened to be used against them. So it's a very reasonable
right.
fear, and it's tough. We don't want to give people misinformation. So I mean, part of meeting with the U.S. Census Office is going to be, you know, give us some real accurate information. We need to be able to reassure people that this is safe.
Yes.
It's very important to us to have to be accurately. I mean, I'm talking about it's like little in the scope of the big democratic picture. Whether or not we get all of the sales tax revenue that we're due or not is very minor. What's much more important is that Nita Lowy and Elliot Engel and everybody else who represents our region is that we
mm-hmm.
are accurately represented in the U.S. government, so that we have so that the communities that have the, and that's of course what the president's trying to suppress, is the
right.
accurate representation in our communities. And I have to say, when I posted something about this census question on Facebook, I had a resident say that it was important that the numbers that are used to determine our representation in federal government are only of eligible voters, which is entirely inaccurate. That person does not understand the U.S.
Right.
Constitution. So the U.S. I mean,
right.
just whether you're a child or you're a documented resident or an undocumented resident, you matter and you count toward our representation. Nita Lowy represents
mm-hmm.
you just like she represents me. So it's very, very important that we have an accurate census count for just the foundation of our democracy, never mind other things like, you know, grant opportunities for population centers of certain districts. You know, like there's a lot of reasons why the census is important to us, but the very foundation of it is so that we're accurately represented in the state and federal government.
Yeah, which needs to be the case. It is frightening how much false information is out there, and it seems that those that are proponents and those that are against, they seem to have this capacity to ratchet it up, and everyone is in disarray. Nobody knows exactly what's what, which is a problem. One thing that always really concerned me about the census was, while there is a tremendous focus on people bilingualism, but that usually just means being able to speak English and being able to speak Spanish. But there's so many other people from so many different countries mm-hmm. in Westchester County alone. We've
mm-hmm.
got people who speak Arabic and Russian and Polish and Korean and Chinese and Swahili. It's just truly amazing how many people from so many different countries. And how do we reach out to them? Or is everything going to be translated to a specific language, especially if it's done on computer? It should be able to be done, shouldn't it? With Google
that's a good question. I'm going to ask more about that when I meet with the census folks. I would hope
mm-hmm.
that any community that has a significant population of whatever language they speak, that they would do the
right.
same thing that we are doing and reach out to trusted sources and community groups that can help make sure that the information is being messaged properly, because it's not just about showing
mm-hmm.
up with a laptop computer to make sure people are – you know, have
right.
the access and the opportunity. It's really a messaging and communication campaign that people know that this is important and that they should
mm-hmm.
do it. They need to do it for the benefit of themselves and their neighbors and everybody else. So if that information is not being communicated in a language people can understand, then it's not being communicated at all. So I certainly hope that it isn't just English and Spanish, because you're absolutely right. And Westchester and the whole metro area has so many immigrants from so many parts of the world where they're going to struggle to understand it in English. And so if you really want to reach
mm-hmm.
them, it has to be in a language they can understand. So I think you're right. I think now that I'm recalling my initial because we've been meeting as a group of stakeholders in Ossining for months, talking about the importance of the census and the importance of us all working together. And I do believe that because it's online, you're right. I think that it's going to be when you actually, if you recognize it's important and you bother to, you figure out how to do it and you get online, I think you probably are going to be able to do it in a number of languages. But getting people to that point is going to require a lot of work. It's a big information campaign and a community campaign.
But what sort of information campaign is there, and why? I mean, there's still discussion about it and how to approach the whole issue. But then, when is the census going to actually take place? So how much longer can we wait before people get to recognize that there are places to go and to facilitate that are safe and comfortable, and the language will be spoken? Is there any promotion at all?
I'll tell you what. My meeting next week is next Thursday. Uh-huh. So when I speak to you on the 15th of July, that Monday, I'll be back on the air with you. I will let you know, because the very first thing that I know as part of the presentation is what is the timeline. And so I will I'll have more information for you then about specifics, hopefully, of when can we start seeing this communication go out, because it takes place in a period of time in 2020. So 2019 is laying the groundwork. Which is why I thought it was a little strange that they felt they needed to have things printed 5 months when there's still 5 months to go in 2019. I always thought that date was a little bit arbitrary. Not that I want this to keep going back and forth in the court system. I'd like it to just the current ruling to stand and for this nonsense to stop, because it's so clearly politically motivated to try and suppress representation in communities like ours. So I very much would like it to move forward. But the fact that this doesn't actually need to happen, it can't happen until 2020. That's what the
right.
Constitution is that it happens every 10 years. So it should be happening in 2020. But all that we're talking about, the communication campaign, I mean, you and me are people who are really paying attention to what's going on in local and federal government. So we're much more attuned to the 2020 census.
maybe we're doing something wrong here. Maybe it's best not to be attuned.
Oh, well, what would be the fun of that?
I don't know. I mean, there'd be nothing to talk about. It's just like life would be boring, you know. But a little bit too much drama for my kids. You know, maybe years ago it was a little different. I could accept more of that drama. But now it's getting tiring.
Oh, well, and it's also, you know, it's funny, I remember when Trump was elected, there was a lot of talk from people who were not supportive of his election, saying we cannot accept this as a new normal. Yeah. He is not a normal president. This is not a normal presidency, not a normal administration.
Right.
And I was reminded of that this weekend because, of course, we're having all these July 4th celebrations and we're talking so much about immigration, and we're talking about this crazy suit, the case that was in front of the Supreme Court and the citizenship question. And somebody there was a posting on social media of one of the last speeches that President Reagan gave, and maybe you remember it or if you've seen it, and it was all about immigration. And, you know, there's many things that I disagree with Ronald Reagan. I mean, the trickle-down economics has been proven false and is absolutely wrong-headed idea economically. But to hear him talk about immigration and our place in the world and the significant role of immigrants and the whole mindset that is the foundation of our country, you would think you were listening to a lefty liberal who had never had a conservative thought in their lives. It was such a different mindset. And for people who were part of the Republican Party in the 1980s, they were still totally wrong-headed about some policies, as far as I'm concerned. It was such a different party, such a different country at that time. And if people who identified that...
Go ahead.
If you think you're a Republican because Ronald Reagan was somebody that inspired you and you were supportive of, then you're a Democrat today. You're not a Republican. Because everything that man said about who we are as a country is the antithesis of what our current president says about who we are as a country.
Well, I guess the thing, the problem is not Democrat or Republican. It's just that we've moved toward identity politics, and that's what's undermined us and divided us on every conceivable level, and that's where we've come. I don't know how that began or why it began, but it's not conducive to America, because that was the whole point, wasn't it? We're not homogeneous like Japan or maybe India or China or some other places, but that's what gave us our strengths, because we weren't that way. And that's what made us so unique in the United States. And I don't know why we're trashing that. And that's become a problem. Maybe because we've lived a life of hyphenated something. We were something American. And maybe that's part of the problem. But also, that was because America was trying to suffocate other people's heritage and ethnicity. And they wanted everyone to become white. So you could be black and then also white. You know, and it went on and on like that. So we're still living, I guess, the crisis of our Civil War and to this day. I wonder when that's going to change.
Yeah. Well, it certainly feels like we're at the tipping point for something.
We've come
so far on one extreme. It's got to swing back. It's got to. And I have to say, this presidential campaign is so exciting. I'm delighted to see that Biden and Bernie are falling in the polls,
mm-hmm.
and that Elizabeth and Kamala are rising in the polls. I couldn't be happier about that. I think there's some, and our own Senator Gillibrand has been really impressive too. There's some really, really great candidates out there. So I am feeling somewhat inspired on the national front with what's going on with the presidential race. And I'm continue to be optimistic that this census will work out, and I know at least on our local level we're paying a lot of attention to it and working with partners at every level of government, and I hope that that's happening throughout the region and the country.
I would think so. Well, we don't have enough time this time, so 2 weeks from now maybe we could talk about the this special project, the State Street development and Hudson Step.
It's an interesting development. It's got a good allegory for other developments. So I'd be happy to talk about that when we get together on the 15th. I look forward to that, Hezzy.
My pleasure. And again, all the best. It's always a
pleasure.
Enjoy
the rest of your weekend.
You.
It is.
You
it
too.
Is.
All the best. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
As Victoria Garrity, the mayor of Ossining, always a pleasure, always a delight. One of the stellar politicians out there. She gives politicians a great name. Well, I see our next guest is on. It's the presumptive mayor of Mount Vernon. Good morning, Sean Patterson Howard. How are you?
Good morning, Hezzy. How are you? Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I'm so excited for the outcome. My God, it was like waiting for I don't know, for Godot, but evidently it came a lot faster. So that you got the final decision certification that you won by 209 votes over your challenger. That's got to be very, very compelling. And evidently the people who supported you and your focus and effort paid off, even though it looked like it was going to be scuttled somehow.
You know, I'm really, really pleased at the voters of Mount Vernon, and I'm grateful, I'm thankful for them choosing me and giving me this opportunity to serve. And I'm excited about getting to work. I'm a workaholic, and so there's nothing that I love better than kind of a spaghetti situation where we have to unravel, straighten out some things, move forward, and serve a family. And Mount Vernon is my family, and so I'm looking forward to doing that.
It is absolutely amazing. I'm just blown away when you come to think of it. Did you actually realize even 6 months ago that this is where you were headed? What germinated in you that said, I could do this. I've got the experience. I've got the knowledge. I've got the capacity to give expression to ideas. And why did you think that this was your destiny, which it evidently is, because the majority of people who went to the polls voted for you? That's very, very compelling.
So, Hezzy, honestly, I've been someone who's worked in and around politics and elected officials for all of my career, because working in the public sector and human services and it's community-based organizations, really community-based organizations or NGOs, non-governmental organizations, as they're called everywhere else in the world, you know, you're doing the work of the government, really funded oftentimes by taxpayer money, and you're doing it in a system that's not heavily bureaucratic. So it's always been public work and public service that my career is focused around, but I never saw myself as an elected official. And honestly, you know, over the past few months or maybe the past years, I continued to see things devolve in Mount Vernon and really budgets. I think it was this budget not being passed by the middle of February this year that caused me to go on a few Facebook rants and lots of people reaching out going, you need to run. You can't stop. You can't just complain. If you're not going to be part of the solution, then you're part of the ongoing problem. And, you know, people had asked me before to run, but I never took it seriously. But the calls got louder. I did a lot of praying because it wasn't about what people were saying externally. They often say when you get frustrated about a situation, it's because you have an ability to fix it. Repair it, address it. And so my frustrations around city government just became louder internally. And I really prayed, and it was about February 16th and 17th, that Saturday and Sunday before the Democratic Convention, that I just sat and I got quiet. I spoke strategically to a few people and said, you know, could this really be a thing? I've never seen it as a thing, and I don't want to jump into this and not have support. And that's literally where it happened. So it's not even 5 months ago, honestly, did I see myself here.
Well, I know that you had received tremendous amount of support from the very beginning. That's when I think we met for the first time. But it had already evolved to the point where people were supportive of you. They wanted to see you in office. And I would tend to believe that your finding solace in prayer seemed to make a lot of sense to me, because somehow you must have realized at the end, yes, you're worthy and you have the capability to be at the top of the I don't know, the political heap, so to speak, the totem pole in a city like Mount Vernon, because, you know, you had the attitude, the right attitude to serve. So it's not like self-service, it's like public service, and a lot of people forget that. So you brought that forward, and did you realize that at that point? Was that what conformed you at the end, or did you find strength in just prayer?
Well, it was a combination of both. It was the strength and the direction and the release in prayer, and understanding that my career had been about servant leadership, and that this would just be servant leadership in a different realm. Being someone that's worked in public administration and public health and public safety, we always talk about policy systems. It's programs, policy system, and environmental change. And I've always worked at the program level. You know, over the past 10, 15 years, I've worked at the policy level. And I've always said to myself, wow, if I could only find some system-level leaders that could understand these issues that our communities are challenged with around economic development, you know, human and social issues, and, you know, public safety, then we would have the right partners. And so this is what this provides me with an opportunity to do, is really work at a systems level, kind of creating policies along with the legislative branch of the city, and really push for environmental and structural change in our community. So
well,
I'm not looking at it as being a politician, but I'm a systems level leader, I guess.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, and I think a lot of people may just not recognize that that really is the job, but they may want to embellish it with other things, but the bells and whistles are what you're looking at. And that's got to be a gargantuan task over the next few months, because you are the presumptive mayor, because most of the people in Mount Vernon vote under the Democratic banner, and even though there may be other challengers with other party affiliations that work out for them at this particular juncture, they don't amount to much percentage-wise. So it's unexpected that people are going to go to another party. So that's why we call you the presumptive mayor. But then what do you do over the next 5-6 months to be prepared? Can you find the people who will actually do that work? Will they be able to communicate your perspective? Will you be able to focus in on economic issues, housing, and abiding by federal and state laws, and so on and so forth, and getting grants and all these things? This all falls under your watch.
Right.
I think it's all doable. You must know.
So, like I said, I'm a workaholic, and so
right.
You know, I haven't really taken a day off. Well, I haven't really, I haven't. I haven't taken
right.
a day off, honestly, since the primary. And so we've been speaking with and
you
we've
need
been
to do
meeting.
That. But you need to do that. You need to
absolutely,
do that. You
absolutely.
Also need to have the strength.
I'll be
mentally.
Doing that. You know, probably from about the 15th through the 20th, I have a conference,
okay.
a work conference I'm going to, and I'll be able to get some quiet time, a little bit of downtime, and
all
then
right.
I'll take some time with my family. But, you know, we've over the past week since the primary, a week and a half since the primary, we've been sitting down with leaders, elected,
mm-hmm.
appointed, and, you know, business leaders, community leaders, just starting those conversations here in the region to talk about how Mount Vernon can work with our surrounding communities. We look forward to diving
yeah.
into those, those conversations more. You know, definitely speaking with the City Democratic Committee as to how do
mm-hmm.
we bring the party together now after such
yes.
a divided and hard-fought primary and
mm-hmm.
focus on bridge building. And that's really when I moved from, because branding is everything, and what you believe you have
yes.
to kind of put out there in front. And so the campaign, the primary campaign, was about believe again. Come on, let's start believing
right.
in our community and believing in our abilities collectively to solve the issues in our community.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we've really moved and we're rebranding, or we're adding on to the branding, hashtag forward together. And I
right.
think that's really important, that we have to move forward as a community together. A house divided against itself can't stand. And so if we want the
mm-hmm.
respect of the communities around us, and in the region and businesses, then they have to see that Mount Vernonites are ready to stand together and, more importantly, work together to address
mm-hmm.
our issues and make sure that we have that we create the proper environment for people to feel welcomed, to live in our community, to do business in our community, that
mm-hmm.
we're focusing on a culture change that's going to be healthy and allow our community to thrive and versus destroying each other.
Well, I guess you began that process when you entered because you felt strongly enough that you could actually lend a hand to change the demeanor of the city, because there was a lack of self-pride and self acknowledgement or lack of assurance that something could change. So, I mean, you've literally thrown off the mantle of the past, even though you're not yet actually in the mayor. But when that happens, I guess the city is ready and waiting for you. Are they going to start to call you, instead of Sean Patterson Howard, are we going to now just shorten your name to SPH? Is that the way we're going?
Well, that's been happening a lot. You know, all of our social media handles were SPH for mayor, and you know, a lot of people tag
okay.
me on social media as SPH. You know, one thing that is exciting, but I have to really caution people about it,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, there are people who are running around now calling me Madam Mayor, and that's really, you know, that.
Mm.
That's nice, and it's wonderful, and it's sweet, and I'm glad
yeah.
that people have that confidence. But like you said, I'm the presumptive mayor, but we have to be careful about the presumptions. I still have a general election
mm-hmm.
in November.
Right.
There's still
right.
a person running on the Republican line. We still have a conservative
mm-hmm.
challenger
yes.
you know, there's always the possibility and a potential of a write-in.
And so
we have to make sure that we run between now and the general election the same way that we ran in the primary. I don't want to take anything for granted. I want to make sure that we're strategic and continuing to reach out to the Mount Vernon constituents, that we're intentional in how we continue to deliver our message and strengthen and build our community, and how we, you know, plan even for transition. And when I say transition, again, that's not presumptive that I'm going to be the mayor, but we have to take advantage of this longer runway that we have to plan. Usually, you know, in November, you get 6 weeks to plan. So right now, we have potentially 6 months. And 6 years can maybe not be enough with all of the challenges that we have, but we have to make the best of the 6 months, and it's not about being arrogant. It's about planning and being prepared, and that's been a theme of my campaign, is that, you know, as leaders in Mount Vernon, we've been too responsive and reactive, and we haven't taken out the time to plan on the front end. And so that's what we're focusing on right now, is building and expanding the tent, unifying the community, planning for the general election, but also planning potentially for transition, should that be.
Well, one thing that is very interesting, and thank goodness there is 6 months, there are 6 months that are left before you might become the next mayor. But I guess the thing to recognize is, are there people in Mount Vernon who have the capacity and are not the old dog and pony type people that just did what they were told because that was the dogma? Are they able to assist in the process of actually serving the public interest? And can you set up a team like that over the next 6 months so that they are ready to go only if and when you win the election?
Absolutely.
And can it be kept quiet so that, you know, these people don't get harassed to the point of, you know, being obliterated by the process? Because there are a lot of people who are just going to want to undermine everything that you do, but I think other people want to celebrate what you're going to do because that's the reason they gave you the plurality.
Absolutely. We are, by sometime next week, we will have a portal set up for people who are interested in submitting their resumes, not just the standard resume, but we're going to set up, you know, whether it's Google Sheets. We want people to talk about their competencies. So we want to list competencies because everything is not just about the job you've done, but the skill sets you have. Many skill sets are transferable.
Right.
So we don't want to just look at duties performed. We want to look at skill sets that people have, influence, you know, community building, financial management, strategic planning, so that we understand, you know, how they might fit. We are pulling together mayoral advisory boards. That's something that we're going to be doing over the next few weeks, as well as looking and identifying people who are interested in being part of our transition team. So, you know, we'll set up a separate portal for that, and clearly we have some people in mind, but we don't want to miss great talent out there. There's even in the NBA, they focus on talent acquisition, but NBA reps go out to the park to see if there's some, you know, some unknown talent out there. And so we're looking at not only known talent, but we want to look at talent that hasn't stepped forward. And that's important. And I have to say that's important because there were people who said, Sean, we never knew you were interested in politics. If we knew you were interested in politics or elected office, then, you know, we might have been able to approach you and have a different conversation. But I didn't know. And there are people out there who may have never thought about working for government, but they see this as an opportunity to serve the community in a different way. And so we want to make sure that we don't overlook those people because you haven't worked in government, that we don't leave you out, but that we find a way to bring you in to this process.
The other thing that's fascinating is here you were, the only candidate who was a female. And did that inform, were you surprised that, you know, this bastion of male supremacy in Mount Vernon, you know, is old concepts, that you were able to even eclipse all that? And that had to go toward your intellect, your, your demeanor and your experience, and so that eclipsed everything else. So evidently, women are acceptable in our leadership, even in Mount Vernon.
Yes, definitely, even in Mount Vernon. You know, I have to make sure I don't forget our councilwoman, Delia Farquharson.
No.
She, you know, was candidate. She ran. She did have a write-in campaign. She did participate in at least one of the debates, and she actively campaigned. She actively campaigned to the end. She knocked doors. She showed up at events.
Right.
She put out information, and I don't know what the final count on the write-in vote is, but she had support of men and women. And at the same time, it's really interesting when I think about those who pushed me the hardest and really pushed to recruit me to run. 8 out of 10 of them were men. 8 out of 10 of these individuals were men. So it wasn't a gender-based campaign, and I think I probably pushed against that harder initially than anyone, because a lot of guys are saying, you know, you're a woman, and this is the year of the woman. But I didn't want to discount the fact that I was a woman, but I didn't want that to be why people voted for me. I wanted them to see my qualifications.
Well, I think people do. It's just and that was the basis of it, not for any other reason. But you know, they say that you know a woman of such dignity and prowess and education and experience, when she talks, you know, other leaders listen, and evidently that is the case. And men do listen. So even though it may take us a while to get there, but you know, hey. That's a hormonal thing. So
and I have
all
to say,
challenged. What can I tell you?
with you know, it was just exciting. Yesterday was the 4th of July, and I think yesterday was kind of the first day that was almost a normal day for me in almost the past 5 months, because I got up and I ran errands, and I went to CVS, and I went to Staples, and, you know, I did some of those things. These are things that my husband, who's incredible, has done for so long, but yesterday I just wanted to get up and run errands. And get in my car with music and listen to some music as I went from place to place. And I went into CVS, and there were two young ladies, one in high school, one in college, and they were talking as they were looking for some things, and they kept looking at me, and they said, "Are you our new mayor?" And I said, "Well, I just won the primary. I'm not the new mayor yet." But they got really excited. And just started talking to me about being a role model and a trailblazer.
Right.
And then I started asking them about, you know, where they were in school and what they were studying. And you know, I think in that moment it began to hit me a little bit that this is an opportunity for not just our young women but our young leaders in the community to see that their dreams are possible. And that they have to pursue what they desire, and even if not everyone supports them. And that's some of the conversation that I really want to have with people going forward, that not everyone will always support you. And oftentimes you might feel insufficient within yourself to maybe pursue your dreams. But what do you do to push past those negative self-thoughts? Because that's the biggest challenge, is it's not other people challenging who you are and what your qualifications are. Many of us in our own heads tear ourselves down and say things to us, ourselves, that we would never allow anyone else to say. And so many people don't pursue their dreams because they can only think of the negative. And that's something that I've struggled with over my career. But as a leadership development person, I had to start holding myself to the same standards that I espoused when I talk to other people. Don't be afraid. Okay, even if you're afraid, like Nike, just do it. Push into it.
Exactly.
Go out and get a team around you who can support you, but who can also right-size your expectations, tell you the truth, and tell you when you're wrong. And so I couldn't keep being a cheerleader for others and tear myself down. And so, you know, I think that's probably one of the biggest learnings in this, is that all of us, you know, we're all becoming. We're becoming. We haven't any job that you walk into on day one. that mm-hmm. know everything and there's no opportunity for you to grow is the wrong job. And so, you know, like any other person, when I walk into the office on January 1st, if the voters elect me in November, there are things that I'm going to have to learn. I'm going to have a lot on day one, but there is still going to be great opportunity for me to learn, and I push into that learning curve. That's who I am, mm-hmm. and I seek help. So, no, I'm not going to know everything that I need to know, but what I do know is what I need to learn. I have a willingness to learn, and I'll surround myself with people who can help me learn and make sure that I'm doing the best work for the constituents of Mount Vernon.
Well, you know, that relates to me. I think the biggest problem in my life was I never really felt assured of who I was. It took me a tremendous amount of time. I guess I really didn't feel that I was complete somehow until I hit my late 40s, early 50s. It's amazing. I mean, how dumb can it be, you know? But I guess you need to believe, and you need people to support you and tell you that. And that's not always easy in this world. So we ostracize a lot of each other, and which is a shame. So I don't know. You've got so much before you, and there's a lot of pressure on you to be the example that everybody's been waiting for. I don't think you're the next Messiah, but certainly, you know, you're up there, you know, and people are going to look for you to you for direction and guidance and wisdom. Can you surmount a lot of the past issues? And one doesn't know exactly how, and I don't want to get into specifics of what some of the issues are, because there are so many, and you'll choose which ones you want to tackle in the beginning, and you'll move on and escalate your efforts as, you know, you heal a city that's not been healed for a very long time.
Right. So, you know, I'm grateful because Mount Vernon, even in a community where we might fight and we might disagree and where
mm-hmm.
we might support other people, I've received an outpouring of support from,
yeah.
you know, past political rivals or people who supported other candidates during this process,
uh-huh.
you know, and so anyone who takes over my position here at the Y or who even applies for it, I would love for them to, you know, come and tap into me and say, what were some of your biggest learnings? And so in the same
right.
fashion, I've reached out already to former Mayor Davis and sat and had an initial
nice.
Conversation and looked to have more. You know, what are some of your biggest learnings?
Mm-hmm.
What would you do different? What worked?
Right.
You know, I'll do the same thing for Clinton Young, former Mayor Clinton Young.
Right.
You know, Richard Thomas, you know, that day will come. It may not come in the next few weeks
eventually.
Or months, but it will eventually come. You know, reaching out to Senator Ruth Hassel Thompson. Definitely.
God, yeah.
I'm reaching out already and have started conversations with my good friend and supporter here in Yonkers, Mayor Mike Spano, and I'm going to reach out to
mm-hmm.
Mayor Bramson and Mayor Roach and, you know, just different
mm-hmm.
people who found themselves in this seat, because where you sit is where you stand, and until you've sat in the seat,
right.
you don't fully understand the gravity and the responsibility of the seat. So I want to speak to people who've had to do the job not only in Mount Vernon but in surrounding communities and get some of their learnings, you know, learn also from
well,
our
when you know,
county executive.
But, right. Well, when you know who you are, you know where to sit. And so that's very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully you'll also meet people like Mayor Marvin of Bronxville, a brilliant
yes.
woman. And before you came on today, I was talking to another brilliant, you know, government officials, none other than the Austin Mayor, Victoria Garrity. These are some stellar people that, you know, have tackled a lot of different issues. And successfully, evidently, they know how to bring community together, even though the disparate interests by so many people. That's every society is that way. But they're able
Absolutely.
To bridge it.
And there are women who are leading
strength,
communities.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm? There are women who are leading
strength,
communities. So I'll reach out
right,
to them
absolutely.
Definitely, and I've heard you mention their names in the past, and so I've written them down, and I will be intentional
okay.
before the day is out to reach out to both of those leaders and you
yeah.
know, schedule some type of time hopefully over the next few months that they'll be available to sit and speak with me. But, you know, I guess really I know our time is running out, and what I really want to say also is there is still an election in November. And the election in November, even if there was no one running against me, and I do, I still have two people who are running against me. But I think what we have to do as Mount Vernonites is show, even through the voting process, that we are united as a community, that we have tapped back into the political process, that Mount Vernon can bring out voters and numbers who are informed and educated and aware. You know, we'd love to see a great number of people come out, because that will send a message throughout the county and throughout the state that Mount Vernon voters are reengaged in the political process. And so it will help us with our seat at the table at the county and in the state, saying Mount Vernon has the ability to bring out 10, 15, 20,000 votes. And I know growing up, I heard that all the time, saying Mount Vernon had the ability and the respect of being able to really impact any election in the county. And so county leaders came to Mount Vernon and they courted Mount Vernon. State leaders came to Mount Vernon and courted us, as well as, you know, national leaders courted us. And so I want to make sure that we get back to that place. And it's really important. And in closing, the next thing I'm really, really focused on in the process and in the midst of all of this is the census. We don't have a complete count committee. Mount Vernon's had the lowest response rate for years in the mail, and we have to make sure that if, you know, we are primed and ready to do this census, get a high response rate, because we're going to have to live with those numbers for the next 10 years, you know, the next decade or more, and that impacts, you know, voting power, it impacts legislation, it impacts federal funding, state funding, county funding, and so we have to do this the right way, and we can't wait until January to start this process. We have to start now.
Well, that was so very interesting, because I was talking to Mayor Garrity about this same issue, and I didn't realize, but Mayor Garrity did, that there are now new methods to reach out to people, because in the past, many communities were not counted because people, the census pollers, were afraid to go to certain buildings or certain neighborhoods, and it became a real problem. So there was an undercount, and then you have also immigrants that were afraid. But now they're considering actually doing this all electronically. So there'll be places where people could go, like the library, for example, where people can fill out their forms, and if they speak a different language, they might be able to have the documentation switched over through Google Translate, and they'll be able to read it and understand it in whatever language they speak. So there are just so many compelling things that can be done, and she seems to be on the cutting edge with that as well. It was just a great discussion today.
Yeah, the Y here served as a place where people came in 2010 to complete their census forms. We provided translators, and even in the process of running and getting signatures, you know, I engaged people who were comfortable walking in Fleetwood and people who were comfortable walking in Leavister. And so these are people that I would reengage. They are stakeholders in every community, and when you tap into those who are the gatekeepers for those community, then you empower them to make sure that they go out and they make sure that their community is represented. So we're going to look at all sectors, and we're not looking to leave anyone out. Mount Vernon, I believe there's closer to 90, 100,000 people in Mount Vernon, and this number of 69,000 that we continue to push forward is such a gross undercount. We have to get the right numbers and the representation.
Exactly. That's perfect. Well, you got a lot to do. Thank you for making the time for our listeners. Always a pleasure. None other than SPH, Sean Patterson Howard.
Thank you, Hezzy. Enjoy your weekend.
You too. All the best. Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And so there we have it, Sean Patterson Howard. She won the election for mayor in the city of Mount Vernon. And she's not taking it for granted, because there may be other challengers down the road. And so she's got to keep and stay on message and engage people and maintain their interest and concern. And so, you know, there's a lot on her plate. And but I think the fact that there is time between now and the general election in November, that gives her a lot of time for planning and strategizing and getting people that can do the job to serve the public interest in a manner that may actually excel the ones that we've had in the past, because a lot of it is based on the demeanor of the leadership. So, and she's an example of the leadership that one can expect from her, as well as from others that she will probably gravitate to and who will gravitate to her. Very, very fascinating state of affairs, so to speak. Well, let's look and see what else is going on in our neck of the woods. Well, one of the things that's really big, big news, of course, is that Iran has condemned, but the U.S. has applauded, Britain's seizure of an Iranian oil tanker in Gibraltar. Well, it seems the White House National Security Advisor John Bolton applauded the interception by Britain's Gibraltar Thursday of a supertanker believed to be carrying Iranian crude oil to Syria, saying the ship was breaking international sanctions. The Grace One, that was the tanker, was impounded by the British territory, which is of Gibraltar, on the southern tip of Spain, after sailing around Africa, the long route from the Middle East to the mouth of the Mediterranean. Now, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the British ambassador to voice, quote, its very strong objection to the illegal and unacceptable seizure, end quote, of its ship. The diplomatic gesture lifted any doubt over Iran's ownership of the vessel, which flies a Panamanian flag and is listed as managed by a company in Singapore. A statement sent out on Friday today, Iran's foreign ministry said that in the meeting with the British ambassador, Tehran had, quote, called for the immediate release of the oil tanker, given that it has been seized at the request of the United States based on the information currently available, end quote. Well, America and our allies will continue to prevent regimes in Tehran and Damascus from profiting off this illicit trade, Bolton, the ambassador, had said on Twitter. And he basically said, excellent news. UK has detained the supertanker Grace One, laden with Iranian oil bound for Iran, for Syria, in violation of European Union sanctions. America and our allies will continue to prevent regimes in Tehran and Damascus from profiting off this illicit trade. So the thing to remember here is that it is not a policy from the United States, but rather the European Union's demand to the boycott of Syria, and that's the issue. So, so shipping data reviewed by Reuters suggested that the tanker was carrying Iranian oil loaded off the coast of Iran, although its documents say that the oil is from neighboring Iraq. While Europe has banned oil shipments to Syria since 2011, it had never seized a tanker at sea. Unlike the United States, Europe does not have broad sanctions against Iran. Quote, this is the first time that the European Union has done something so public and so aggressive. I imagine it was also coordinated in some manner with the United States, given the NATO member forces have been involved, said Matthew Orsman, a partner with law firm Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, who advises firms on sanctions. Quote, this is likely to have been meant as a signal to Syria and Iran, as well as the United States, that Europe takes sanctions enforcement seriously and that the European Union can also respond to Iranian brinksmanship related to ongoing nuclear negotiations. That's end quote. Now, authorities in Gibraltar made no reference to the source of the oil or the ownership of the ship when they seized it, but Iran's acknowledgement that it owned the ship and the likelihood that its cargo was also Iranian drew a link between the incident and a new U.S. effort to halt the global sales of Iranian crude. Iran described that as an illegal economic war. European countries have so far tried to appear neutral in the escalating confrontation between Tehran and Washington, which saw the United States call off airstrikes against Iran using just minutes before impact last month, and Tehran amassed stocks of enriched uranium banned under a 2015 nuclear deal. The Gibraltar government said it had reasonable grounds to believe that the Grace One was carrying crude oil to the Banias refinery in Syria. That refinery is the property of an entity that is subject to European Union sanctions against Syria, Gibraltar Chief Minister Fabian Picardo had said, quote, with my consent, our port and law enforcement agencies sought the assistance of the Royal Marines in carrying out this operation. Well, a spokesman for the Prime Minister, Theresa May, welcomed Gibraltar's move. Spain, which challenges British ownership of Gibraltar, said the action was prompted by a U.S. request to Britain and appeared to have taken place in Spanish waters. Britain's Foreign Office did not respond to a request for comment. Iran has long been supplying its allies in Syria with oil despite sanctions against Syria. What is new are U.S. sanctions on Iran itself imposed last year when President Donald Trump pulled out of an agreement that had guaranteed Tehran access to world trade in return for curbs on its nuclear program. And those U.S. sanctions have been tightened sharply since May, effectively forcing Iran from mainstream oil markets and making it desperate for alternative customers. Iran has grown more reliant on its own tanker fleet to transport whatever oil it can sell and to store a growing stockpile of unsold output. The U.S.-Iranian confrontation has escalated in recent weeks, taking on a military dimension after Washington accused Tehran of attacking tankers in the Gulf and Iran shot down a U.S. drone. And Trump ordered airstrikes but called them off at the last minute, later saying too many people would have died. European countries opposed Trump's decision to exit the nuclear deal last year. They have promised to help Iran find alternative ways to export, but with little success so far. Iran has said it wants to keep the nuclear deal alive but must receive promised economic benefits. This week, it announced it had accumulated more low-enriched uranium than the deal allows, and from July 7 will refine uranium to a greater purity than permitted. And by restricting Iran's ability to move oil, U.S. sanctions have choked off Tehran's Syrian allies, causing fuel shortages in government-controlled areas. In May, Syria received its first foreign oil for 6 months with the arrival of two shipments, one from Iran, a source said at the time. And earlier this year, Reuters revealed that the Grace One was one of four tankers involved in shipping Iranian fuel oil to Singapore and China, violating U.S. sanctions. The 300,000-ton tanker is registered as being managed by Singapore-based iShips Management Pte. Limited. Reuters was unable to establish contact with the firm for comment. It was documented as loading fuel oil in the Iraqi port of Basra in December, though Basra did not list it as being in port, and its tracking system was switched off. The tanker reappeared on tracking maps near Iran's port of Bandar Asalyeh, fully loaded. Homayoun Falaksahi, the senior analyst at London-based energy data firm Kepler, told Reuters the ship had loaded Iranian crude in mid-April from Iran's export port of Kharg, or Kharg, K-H-A-R-G Island. I don't know how to pronounce the name of the island. A maritime intelligence source said the ship may have made the journey around Africa to avoid the Suez Canal, where such a large supertanker would have had to unload its cargo and refill after passing through, exposing it to potential seizure. So that was the intent, and that's the big to-do that maybe people have thought about. Well, Let's move over to what's happening a little bit closer to home. Evidently, the strongest earthquake in 20 years has hit Southern California. The strongest earthquake in 20 years shook a large swath of Southern California and parts of Nevada yesterday. The 6.4 magnitude quake struck at 10:33 a.m. local time in the Mojave Desert, about 150 miles northeast of Los Angeles, near the town of Ridgecrest, California. Multiple injuries and two house fires were reported. Emergency crews were also dealing with vegetation fires, gas leaks, and reports of cracked roads. Kern County Fire Chief David Witt told the press. He added that 15 patients have been evacuated from the Ridgecrest Regional Hospital as a precaution and out of concern for aftershocks. Residents were on Friday assessing the damage and cleaning up, and it is likely not over yet. Aftershocks and temblors could be in store in the days ahead, seismologists have said. And Kern County District Supervisor Mick Gleason told CNN there were some structural issues with the hospital, and some patients had to be moved from one ward to another, and that others were taken to a neighboring building. Gleason did not say what the structural issues were. Ridgecrest Mayor Peggy Breeden said that utility workers were assessing broken gas lines and turning off gas where necessary. The local senior center was holding a July 4th event when the quake hit, and everyone made it out, shaken up, but without injuries, she said. Well, oh my goodness, there's another one quake, meaning a quake right now, Breeden said, while on live television as an aftershock struck. Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency for Kern County. The declaration means that the state will help the county and municipalities in it with emergency aid and recovery efforts. Ridgecrest Mayor Peggy Breeden praised Newsom for declaring the emergency. She also thanked other nearby local governments for offering to help with the recovery effort. President Donald Trump said he was fully briefed on the earthquake and that, quote, that it, quote, all means to be very much under control. All seems to be very much under control, end quote. And police and fire officials said at a news conference Thursday afternoon that they had enough resources so far to meet the needs in the wake of the earthquake. Ridgecrest Police Chief Jed McLaughlin said at a news conference that, quote, we have plenty of resources, end quote. California Highway Patrol Lieutenant John Williams said that officials have found cracks on several roads in the county, but overpasses and underpasses are in good shape. A series of aftershocks included a 4.5 magnitude tremor, according to the United States Geological Survey. Quote, it almost gave me a heart attack, said Cora Burke, a waitress at Midway Cafe in Ridgecrest, of the Big Jolt. Quote, it's just a rolling feeling inside the building, inside the cafe, and all of a sudden, everything started falling off the shelf. Glasses and the refrigerator and everything in the small refrigerator fell over. A liquor store in Ridgecrest saw the aisles filled with broken wine and liquor bottles, knocked down boxes and other groceries strewn on the floor. I mopped up over 20 gallons of wine that fell over in addition to the beer, soda, and the cooler that fell over. We have several thousand dollars worth of damage, said the shopkeeper James Wilhorn. U.S. Geological Survey, the USGS seismologist Lucy Jones said more than 80 aftershocks had hit the area in the hours since the initial quake. We should be expecting lots of aftershocks, and some of them will be bigger than the threes we've been having so far, Jones told the news conference. I think the chance of having a magnitude 5 is probably greater than 50-50, she said. Jones said that the 6.4 quake centered near the town of Ridgecrest was preceded by a magnitude 4.2 tremor about a half hour earlier. She said vigorous aftershocks were recurring but striking in a remote area. Now, people from Las Vegas to the Pacific Coast reported feeling a rolling motion and took to social media to report it. The quake hit the edge of Death Valley National Park, about 113 miles northeast of Los Angeles on Thursday. Local emergency agencies also took to social media to ask people to only call 911 for emergencies. We are very much aware of the significant earthquake that just occurred in Southern California. Please do not call 911 unless there are injuries or other dangerous conditions. Don't call for questions, please, the LAPD said in a statement published on Twitter. There were no reports of serious damage or injuries in Los Angeles, the department said. The quake was detected by California's new shake alert system, and it provided 48 seconds of warning to the seismology lab well before the shaking arrived at Caltech in the Los Angeles suburb of Pasadena, but it did not trigger a public warning through an app recently made available in Los Angeles County. So USGS seismologist Robert Graves said the shake alert system worked properly. Graves said it calculated an intensity level for the Los Angeles area that was below the threshold for a public alert. The limits are intended to avoid false alarms. And Glenn Pomeroy, the head of California's Earthquake Authority, said that the earthquake is, quote, an important reminder that all of California is earthquake country, end quote. Very, 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 very compelling news, that is for sure. We quickly go back to our studio screen. We look fine. Wanted to go over some other things as well. Evidently, a United Nations report cites shockingly high number of likely executions in Venezuela. Nearly 7,000 people have been killed during security operations in Venezuela in the past year. A year and a half, actually. The United Nations said this on Thursday, warning that many of the killings likely constituted, quote, executions, end quote. In a fresh report, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, she is initially from Chile, she was a one-time president, said that the Venezuelan government had registered at least 6,856 killed in alleged confrontations with state forces since the beginning of 2018. The incidence of alleged extrajudicial killings by security forces has been shockingly high, Bachelet's office said in a statement. Last year, the government registered 5,287 killings, purportedly for, quote, resistance to authority, end quote, during such operations between January 1 and May 19 of this year. Another 1,569 similar killings were registered, according to the report. The numbers were provided by the Venezuelan government to the United Nations Rights Office in response to a request made by following a visit to the country by a technical team in March, spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani told Agence France-Presse, adding that this was the first time the United Nations had published the figures. The United Nations Rights Chief, who herself visited Venezuela last month, warned in her report that, quote, there are reasonable grounds to believe that many of these killings constitute extrajudicial executions committed by the security forces, end quote. Bachelet presented the report to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva on Friday, that's today, saying that essential institutions and the rule of law in Venezuela have been eroded, end quote. Continuing, she said, many could constitute extrajudicial killings and should be fully investigated with accountability of perpetrators and guarantees of non-recurrence, Bachelet told the council. The statement underscored concerns highlighted in the report by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, the OHCHR, quote, that the authorities may be using FAES and possibly other security forces as part of the policy of social control. Now, these killings warrant immediate investigation to ensure accountability of perpetrators and guarantees of non-recurrence, the report said, urging Caracas, the capital of Venezuela, to, quote, dissolve FAES, referring to Venezuela's special forces, whose FAES is. Now, and Bachelet called on the government to, quote, establish an impartial and independent national mechanism with the support of the international community to investigate extrajudicial executions during security operations, ensure accountability of perpetrators, and redress for victims. Now, Thursday's report also decried a wide range of other grave rights violations in Venezuela, which is caught in an economic crisis and a political standoff between President Nicolas Maduro's government and the National Assembly leader, Juan Guaido. The opposition leader Guaido declared himself interim president earlier this year and has been recognized by the United States and more than 50 other countries. Now, the oil-rich country is also suffering from hyperinflation and shortages of basic goods from food to medicine, a crisis that has forced millions to flee. The report concluded there are reasonable grounds to believe that grave violations of economic and social rights, including the rights to food and health, have been committed in Venezuela. It also said that, quote, as the economic crisis deepened, the authorities began using social programs in a discriminatory manner based on political grounds and as an instrument of social control. The report meanwhile found that sanctions imposed on Venezuela, while not responsible for the country's woes, were, quote, exacerbating further the effects of the economic crisis and thus the humanitarian situation, end quote. Thursday's report charged that Venezuela's government over the past decade, and especially since 2016, had implemented a strategy, quote, aimed at neutralizing, repressing, and criminalizing policy opponents and people critical of the government, end quote. In the statement, the rights office pointed to a series of laws, policies, and practices in Venezuela that it said had, quote, restricted the democratic space, dismantled institutional checks and balances, and allowed patterns of grave violations, end quote. The report noted that as of May 31 of this year, 793 people remained in arbitrary detention in the country, and that so far this year, 22 members of parliament, including Guaido, have been stripped of their parliamentary immunity. In remarks to journalists following the United Nations Human Rights Council, Bachelet announced that the Venezuelan government had released 22 people from jail on Thursday, including 20 students, as well as the well-known judge Maria Afiuni and the journalist Braulio Jatar. Afiuni, detained in 2009 after former President Hugo Chavez demanded she be imprisoned, has been under house arrest since 2011. However, a court issued her with a five-year jail sentence in March. Oh, I tell you, all the stuff that goes on in the world, you would think, my goodness, what is going on? But so much is going on. Now, let's look at some other stuff that we might find of interest. One second. Wanted to just make sure that we're covering as much as possible and that you might find interesting. Well, this is really quite interesting. Just as a note of information, the African Union is setting itself up to launch the operational phase of the AFCTA free trade deal, though many challenges remain, and the Nigeria would be the one that would actually join the rest of the African Union, and that would create an unbelievable behemoth that can actually elevate literally Africa to an unbelievable extent. So it's going to be really interesting to see where that leads. And you might find this slightly interesting. Seems that Brexit could impact the environment. So when you live in Europe, the air you breathe, the water you drink, and the meat or fish you eat are all controlled in Brussels. And that could no longer be the case for the United Kingdom, and due to Brexit, the country is now entering uncharted territory, and the environment could become collateral damage. And that's the whole issue. About 80% of the United Kingdom's environmental rules derive from European laws, which over the past decades have played a leading role in helping the country clean up. So previously considered the dirty man of Europe, the United Kingdom has reduced its carbon dioxide emissions by 38% since 1990, faster than any other major developed country. So the big question is, how could the United Kingdom's European Union withdrawal impact the environment? And the government has promised a green Brexit, but activists worry much of the progress made could be undone. And so that's going to become a major, major compelling study, and we'll see where that goes. So we'll just see where, you know, how that's going to lead forward. Let me quickly look at some other things. We covered this whole oil seizure from Iran. I guess that's it. That's it. So there we are at the end of our the ropes today. Want to thank you for being with us. I want to thank Mayor Garrity, Victoria Garrity, the mayor of the Ossining, and always compelling. And, of course, to Sean Patterson Howard, who won the Democratic primary elections for mayor. And so we'll see her probably challenged by three other people in the November, I think it's November 3 elections. The general election, and we'll see what happens then. But at the moment, I still think of her as the presumptive mayor because 80% or more of the registered voters in Mount Vernon are Democrats, and the other parties, you know, Republican, conservative, or non-affiliated and write-in ballots are just not the way that Mount Vernon has expressed itself in the past. So have a great weekend, and look forward to speak to you on Monday. So there's a lot to do and a lot to think about. Thank you again. Goodbye.